Welcome to Books and Beyond with Bound. I'm Tara Khandelwal.
And I'm Michelle DeCosta.
In this podcast, we talk to India's finest authors
and uncover the stories behind the best written book
and dissect how these books shape our lives and worldviews today.
So let's dive in.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Books and Beyond. And today we are very excited to speak to Anita Mani, whose anthology, Women in the Wild, unpacks the lives of 9 fascinating women wildlife conservationists in India who were the first in their field. And through this book, we journey across the length and breadth of India's wild spaces, from forests, rivers, oceans, to the mountains. And we go along this journey with these women to these remote locations. They have long hours, no beds, close encounters with animals, close encounters with bears, some very, very interesting stories, how they deal with sexism, the male gaze. So right from Vijaya, who's one of India's first female herpetologists, whose research into the killing of olive ridley turtles led to Indira Gandhi banning the turtle trade, to Jamal Ara, India's mysterious bird woman. There's so many. These women have seen it all. And Anita is so passionate about wildlife conservation that she has her own imprint with Juggernaut. And what I really, really liked about this book, apart from, you know, all of the beautiful, amazing wildlife that you feel immersed in, is the fact that it really chronicles these firsts. You know, growing up, I grew up in the 90s, and even then there were such few role models. We didn't even see women in the workplace when I was growing up. And these women not only have left, you know, conventional roles, but have gone beyond desk jobs, something that I could never even think of, gone out into the open when there was nobody in front of them, and really gone into the field. And, you know, this is sort of like a fantasy for all aspiring women conservationists out there. So let's hear more about these phenomenal women from Anita and how they pioneered their way into this very, very interesting field. Welcome, Anita.
Yeah, thank you. And we are happy to be here and excited to talk about the book.
So before we begin, you know, I want to know all about the stories of these women. But before that, I want to know a little bit about your journey, because your journey you've written in the book is very similar to a migrating bird, because you oscillated from newspapers, writing for newspapers, to a corporate career, and now back to writing. So when did you get interested in wildlife? Was it present during all of these changes in your careers? And why this book now?
So in a sense, yeah, I mean, it's been a really long, strange journey. I trained as a journalist. I wrote on communications and information technology for several years. And I worked with an investment bank that raised capital for communications companies, incubated a software startup with them, ran those operations for a bunch of years, and went back to doing more consulting for a few other companies, and then came back to writing. So thematically, communication has been the only thread that sort of holds my career together. The interest in wildlife came much, much later, like say about 15, 16 years ago, when I began bird watching. So, and it's been a really interest that has gathered more and more momentum as the years pass. And today it's sort of, it's a hobby, it's work, it's what I do. It sort of defines me in many ways, I think, for myself, not in terms of public definition, but I think in terms of my outlook on many things, on public policy, on rights, on the way we live, I think is all shaped by this interest in a way. So, I mean, the tragedy, of course, is that I was doing a job with a software company that had operations in some of the most remarkable geographies. We had like projects going on across Southern Africa, Eastern Africa, Central Africa, in Southeast Asia, all which are all burning hotspots. And to this day, I bemoan the fact that when I was working for them and could have traveled to all these places, I wasn't much of a birder at all. So, you know, so really it has been ironical twist in the tail, so to speak.
Oh God, yeah, I can only imagine the missed opportunity. But anyway, there'll be more opportunities coming up as well. And what's so interesting about this book is that you've edited it. It's actually an anthology of all of these different essays. And it's just not just a one-off thing. In fact, you have an imprint with Juggernaut, specifically for bird lovers, conservationists, and policymakers. And the imprint is called Indian Pitta, which is where this book is published under. I was very interested in that as well because, as someone in the publishing industry, when I saw that Juggernaut has an imprint just for this audience, I was wondering, how did this imprint even come about? And, is there that much of a demand for such stories about, about this topic and the audience for it? So if you could let me know a little bit more about that.
I think there's an upsurge of interest in activities like bird watching. I think like the pandemic provided its own impetus because everyone said better to be outdoors than indoors. So, when bird watching is an outdoor activity that you can do in a city, you don't necessarily have to go to far off exotic places. And this, at least in India, we're seeing a huge upsurge of interest in birding. Like the Delhi Bird Club outings were, in the years that when I started birding with the club. We would have five, six, seven, eight people, on a walk on a Sunday, on a weekend morning. Today, for the more popular walks, you will get like 50, 60, 100 people. So I'm really there's been a huge amount of interest in bird watching and bird photography. And I think that's what made me think that, maybe I should marry my interests in writing. Like I was before I started Indian Pitta, I was running a children's newspaper for 10 years. So, writing has been an area of interest, but to marry my interest in writing and birding. And I think Juggernaut saw the opportunity in terms of me having a niche committed audience, because in India, although we have good books about birds, many of these were like field guides, which help you identify a species or more academic writing. There wasn't a middle path, popular science writing, which talks about nature, ecology, landscapes, habitats, and experiences that sort of, and well written. I mean, I think that's really important for Indian Pitta. I think that's, I mean, I'd like to say, think that our books stand out as much for the subjects as the fact that how well they are written. They appeal to a broader audience, I think Juggernaut, I think the so and they saw the opportunity, in speaking to such a niche audience, a committed audience, and that's why the idea of imprint for nature, wildlife, that's broadly our canvas, and birds was born.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And the writing is fabulous, the kinds of journalists that you've also commissioned and that you've curated, each one of them really weaves the story of each of these women really well. And I identify with that because during the pandemic, there was nothing to do. So I would also go up to my terrace every morning for a walk. And the only thing to do to keep me entertained was to look at all the eagles and wonder about what they're doing and why they're doing. And then there were some parrots and sparrows. And I suddenly became like really interested in bird behavior where I wasn't before. Okay, so coming to the stories of your book. So the book starts with a very interesting profile of Jamal Arra. And she is India's first female self-taught ornithologist, who is a person who studies birds. And I love that she is self-taught, and her story is written in such an interesting way because she comes onto the scene, she writes a number of scientific papers, she becomes quite well known, and then she disappears. The person who wrote this essay, Raza Kazmi, he's a wildlife historian, and he says that until the 20th century, ornithology had been a male bastion. So she really was, a pioneer in terms for women, in terms of bird watching. So could you tell us how you found this fascinating profile and how you decided to include it? And can you tell us a little, tell, can you tell our listeners a little bit more about this woman?
Right. I mean, the Jamalara essay itself has a story behind it. When I was sort of putting the idea for the book together, so I had a long list of people that we could write about, right? And I, then the idea was to match the people we wanted to include with the writers who knew them well. So, and for some, Jamalara was in my list because, she has written the book with the longest publishing history in birding. It's a simple booklet written, published by the NBT called Watching Birds. And many a bird watcher who began in the era of 80s and 90s when there weren't too many books around, probably bought the book. And it introduced you to birds and watching common birds around you and things like that. And many people thought that Jamal Lara was also a man because the name doesn't suggest immediately the gender, right? So, but, we couldn't find anyone who knew much about Jamal Lara. If you search about Jamal Lara on the internet, pre-Women in the Wild, there's no information. And, I was chatting with Ashish Pitti, who is also an Indian Pitta author, and Ashish is an authority, on the bibliography of South Asian ornithology. And Ashish threw up his hands and said, there's hardly any information out there. And I think if Ashish doesn't know, there are very few people who actually do. So I said, okay, we'll park it, but I'm still going to see whether we can find a way to bring a profile of Jamal Lara into the book. And it so happened that I was introduced to Raza Kazmi in a completely different context. I wanted to talk to him about his work and maybe talk about whether he could do some writing for Indian Pitta. And I began telling him about the books we were doing, about Women in the Wild. And he said, hey, Anita, I'm actually writing a long-form essay for another long-form essay portal on this woman ornithologist from Ranchi, who no one knows about. So I said, Raza, are you writing a profile of Jamal Lara? And he said, Raza says, yes, how did you guess? I said, it was just a lucky guess. I said, hold it right there. And when Raza's academic erudition, his ability to deep dive into topic, anybody who's read his work, and I have been reading him for some time, is well known. And so I knew if he's on the hot on the heels of uncovering Jamal Lara's story, he probably has the best bet of coming up with a really arresting profile. So on that call, I persuaded him to stop providing this piece to the long form web portal. And I said, let's publish it in the book and then you can publish it wherever you want. I'll make sure that we get the permissions to do that. So luckily, Raza, I think, liked the idea. He agreed. And then over the next few months, I think he did this, what I call as literary forensics in terms of uncovering any bit of information about Jamal Lara that he could find online. He had already tracked down Jamal Lara's daughter, and he explains in the essay how that happened purely by chance. And Madhuka is really old and frail. So, it was probably among the last few opportunities to actually document Jamal Lara's life. So the essay came together in this most, most amazing manner. It was almost as though it was meant to be. And the minute I knew I had Jamal Lara in the book, we said we would leave the book with her because in a sense, she's also the first of her kind. And, in terms of wildlife biology, she's among the earliest women to work in this space. So, yeah, so that's how the profile came about.
And it's very interesting. I love hearing about the stories behind the stories. And the stories themselves, about these women and how they were in the field, the travels that they took, all of that was so interesting. So my favorite story was about Vidya, who's studied leopards, and she studied how leopards can actually live amongst human populations. And I found that so interesting because there was you describe in the book the journalist describes in the book how she used to collar these leopards, and what used to happen is that they used to reforest these leopards. So they used to take them from these agricultural lands and put them back into the forest. But that actually led to a lot of stress and a lot of human leopard interaction. Whereas actually, leopards can coexist with humans. And there's this one story of Ajoba, who means grandfather, and he's a leopard, where they released him somewhere and then he made his way all the way back to his home, which was in Bombay.
Yeah.
And it just made me think, recently we have so many stories of leopards in Bombay, there was leopards in Nasik, leopards, and it's become so common. And I think she is one of those people that sort of, have made it more normal for us and made us understand how, leopards can actually live amongst human populations. So that was my favorite story. But I wanted to know from you, out of all of the stories in the book, which was your favorite story?
Let me answer this question a little differently. I wouldn't pick one essay over the others. But something that I had a very strong connect to was the story about Jay Vijaya, Vijay's photo is the one on the cover. And in many ways, that is special to me because it was Vijay's photo that triggered the whole book in a way. When I started Indian Pitta 2 summers ago, mulling over the kind of books that we would do in the first year. And this photo I had seen some many years ago in Sanctuary magazine, and it sort of jumped out at me, and I was like, who is this really vibrant, active person? It's so the photo was so intriguing in many ways. So I've been reading up about Viji over the years, about her life, and you know, the highs and the lows, and there were many high highs and many low lows. And she grew up in Chennai of the 70s and 80s, and I'm a Chennai girl too. So this is a city I understand. I mean, I know the social milieu in which she grew up and how difficult it must have been to deal with career challenges and her personal challenges, you know, in that setup. So there was a great connect one felt without even knowing her or her family. So, and I remember I was, I think, somewhere in the Garo Hills of Meghalaya when I said, okay, we've just got to do this book and I'm going to see whether we can get Zai Whittaker to write the profile, because I worked with Viji. So managed to connect with her all the way across from somewhere in the middle of the Garo Hills. And Zai said, I will do the profile, but if the family agrees, because you know, it's important. It's a sensitive story in some, at some levels. It was important for her that the family be fully on board. So then right from there, I remember getting hold of Viji's sisters, who are still, you know, one of them who lives in Delhi, the other in Chennai. And we had a conference call one late one evening, and they said, yes, we're happy for Viji's story to actually make it to a book. And such a beautiful photograph that it just so organically went on the cover. And I think, like I said, you know, it was so fitting, because this is a photo for that was a trigger for the book, for the whole book, for me at least, that put the idea of the book in my mind. And yeah, so I'm so happy that it actually made it to the cover. So
that's lovely. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. And for context, she is Turtle Girl, also called Turtle Girl, India's first herpetologist who documented...
First female herpetologist.
Yes, India's first female herpetologist who documented the movement of turtles all over the country. And I was actually going to ask you about the cover of the book. And this brings me to the next thing I was curious about. What about some of the reactions to the book?
That's the amazing thing. I mean, not a single one of them had any idea, I think, until the book was out and we were just doing the launch event in Bangalore, when we got a lot of the biologists who could come to Bangalore on a stage to talk about issues around women in the wild. And that's when a lot of them actually got to know who were the other women in the book, because the book had just come out. We were just sending out the preliminary copies to the subjects and the authors. I mean, that's how non-self-absorbed these women are. So, you know, I think that makes a point there, because nobody asked me, who else is in the book, you know, and stuff like that. No, I mean, many of them read their own essays for the first time. I mean, they had read them, I'm sure, while his profile was being created. But in his final form, they all read it in the book. So
that's wonderful.
Yeah, I think they're all far too caught up in their own work and what drives them, rather than, you know, a book like this. You know, it's really an exercise for them in hoping to share the message in order to, you know, get the message across to other young women entering the field. I think that's the only motivation for participating in a book like this. I don't think there's anything else.
Sure. So what is interesting, you know, that there are certain patterns that came out in all of the biologists' life, from their hard work, their persistent and male-dominated field. And, you know, there are the obvious problems like the potential lack of sanitation, working in extreme temperatures. But what I also found interesting was that you say that women biologists were often discredited for having emotions about their work. And there's an example of Jane Goodall being made fun of for naming the chimpanzees.
Yeah.
You know? And I found that so weird. And I also started thinking, you know, about this whole Me Too angle as well. Like one aspect was the emotional angle, which is the labeling and all of those. And another angle that I found very like strange was, not strange, but it made me think about how Me Too is prevalent in every single industry, right? From, you know, obviously when we think Me Too, we think corporate film, all of those things, but it is prevalent everywhere, right? From, you know, this field to the field of even philanthropy, right? The field that you think, oh, probably, you know, wouldn't happen. It's just happening everywhere. And I found it quite shocking.
Yeah. I mean, I agree, because, you know, in a sense, the issues that these women faced is not different from the issues women face in other lines of business. But I think what makes this, in a sense, for lack of a better word, unique, is the fact that they are working in remote places, where you're making a whole bunch of adjustments. You're often working at night, you're working without access to, proper loose sometimes. You're working at odd hours, long hours. So I think that aggravates a lot of the underlying issues, and that they come out in different ways. Yeah, I think gender is an issue when it comes to work culture, no doubt about it. And sometimes it's very well-meant, well-meaning genderization of roles happens. So where other male colleagues don't want you to do certain things because it's not safe. So they worry about protection when they should actually be worrying about enablement.
Right, exactly. Like also there's certain in the book it's mentioned there's certain areas that are considered unsafe for women to go to.
Yeah,
Yeah.
and I think it's I'm not saying it as a general truth, but honestly, after burning in some of the more remote areas in India, I think we are far safer in the remote areas where everyone knows everybody, rather than in the hubbub of cities where no one knows anyone and there's no accountability in the system at all.
Yeah, I've actually spoken to some other authors who've done a lot of research in rural India, and there is always this conversation, about women's safety, and that is a hindrance. That is a hindrance to women journalists, researchers, people in conservation. Some of them have to resort to taking sort of male guardian. Some of them have to opt out, and I think that was showcased really well in the book as well, especially in a field like this where you have to be. Sort of, it is not a desk job, and that's what's so remarkable about this, especially since some of the stories, are women, in the 60s and 70s, where it wasn't even heard of for women to leave the house. And some of them even came upon this passion of theirs very serendipitously, where they just had a love for animals and, sort of forged ahead and really were the first women to do this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable. And it makes me think of another book called Lady Doctors by Kavita Rao, which is also a book about, the first female Indian doctors and how, we are so used to having like we want role models. I want to see someone ahead of me doing it before, but I just find it so fascinating that at a time when it was just unheard of, these women op had a, their mind open enough to conceive of something and go and do it, which is, I
Yeah.
think, the main thing. Yeah.
Very true, and I think that's the same reaction that's the book has had for young biologists. I mean, I've had the chance to talk about the book with young science students in cities like Hyderabad and Pune, and it has really resonated with women. I mean, they say, okay, this book is talking about stuff that's happening to me in my life, and that validates what I'm going through. Because a lot of there are very few platforms to talk about some of the issues that these women raise. And sometimes you're not necessarily looking for a solution, you're just looking for solidarity, shared experiences and validation of what you are one is personally going through. That I'm not a loony for getting worried about what's happening to me. This is actually a legitimate concern. This is a legit issue. Other people have been down the road, so maybe I can learn. So I mean, I've had so many young women walk up to me and say that, it really resonated for us. And I think that for me is a fantastic validation for the book and the fact that there was a need for something like this, So yeah,
Yeah, absolutely.
well, some of the stories, I mean, Vidya's work, since you mentioned Vidya, is well known. I think especially in Bombay, where her work with leopards, with SGMP, is very well known. But the idea of this book was to give space in the long form. We all are reading these short newspaper articles that don't cover nuances. And I think as a society, we are so becoming so averse to nuances. I think the long form explores that. And I was so clear about it that we could have covered 50 women if we had just made it into shorter essays. But that was not the intention of the book. The idea was in the book to dwell on the journeys. And while the women, in a sense, are there because of the outcomes, what really stands out in the book are the journeys rather than the outcomes, I think.
Yeah, definitely. From, the marriages to, there's mental health. Jamal Ara has a mental health issue. That is why she disappeared. So the exploration of that. So there's a lot else that's going on in the book. And actually, that brings me to my next question, is that, you mentioned in another interview that women in this field, definitely the numbers increasing. And so, how did you pick sort of, because there are only 9 essays. So, what was your curation process? How did you sort of pick who you're going to include? Were there people that you wanted to include, which you said, okay, maybe not now, maybe next time? What was it like?
Like I said, we had a long list, and of course, I was chomping on about it for quite some time. Until a friend of mine who sat me down and told me that, you know, Anita, this is all fine. All of these women probably deserve to be there at some level, and it is not a single woman on in another long list who doesn't whose story is not worth telling. But he sat down and said, look, you need to have criteria so you can justify it to yourself first and foremost. And then justify to the world at large when you get asked a question as to why did you pick these women in the book and not others? Well, for me, the answers has two layers. One is the fact that we had room only for a certain number of profiles. You know, there's a publishing budget at the end of the day, and I was very clear on long form. So that means that we could only cover an X number of profiles. And the second was, I think the criteria that I applied was because it was the first book of its kind, and there hasn't been an anthology in this same line. It was very important to have to cover women whose work had had substantial impact on species or landscape conservation. So that's where I sort of took my cue from broadly. But having said that, and I think I've said this every time and to everyone who wants to listen or doesn't want to listen, that this is not an exhaustive list because, like I said, there are so many stories out there that just need to be told. But we have to make a start somewhere. We had to, you know. And also, what also guided me in some ways, subliminally, maybe not overtly, was whom the writers knew. You know, sometimes the choice of you know, do we cover A or B is also made because I have a brilliant writer who knows A very, very well. And you know, so then it becomes easier to commission saying, okay, let's do this profile because I know that you'll be able to get under the skin of the person and tell the story the way it deserves to be told.
And did you have sort of like a mix of like, obviously, you would have a mix of like time period or species or what those criteria as well?
No, not. I mean, in a sense, I wanted to do a broad geographic spread and not concentrate only on women from one part of the country. So we have women from the northeast, from the west, from the coast. You know, it's got a broad swathe of profiles covered. But there was not. Those were not rigid criteria. The important thing was outcomes. That was really primary. I mean, the other stuff was just. You know, was just secondary criterion that one applied.
And did you sort of have any directives for the writers who were writing these essays? For example, you know, how much of the personal to bring in, or any format, or anything like that? Or were they sort of free to write it as they would? And what was your editorial input?
No, the most of them are published writers in their own, published authors in their own right. You know, so. But there's very little I need to tell them in terms of how to deliver the story, right? So I think the only thing I must have told them was to that we had a broad word limit, that then it was long form, so that they could then, you know, have the space to write, to get into the kind of detail that you don't get the luxury of getting into at other times. But like I said, my job was really very editing with a very light touch. I would like to believe. So you might need to ask my writers whether that holds true or not.
Okay, and what kind of books, I mean, do you like about conservation? So I recently read a book called What's Left of the Jungle by Nitin Sekar.
Yeah, I finished the same book last week.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so I loved it. I absolutely love that book because it really sort of through the eyes of a villager, Akshu told us so much about the practicalities and you know, the conflicts that humans and animals face when it comes to conservation. So what other books would you recommend?
I don't recommend. I mean, that's something I just don't do. I think everybody's in, then it's very didactic to say that these are the books. I mean, the books I love. I mean,
Which
and
ones do you like? Which ones do you like on conservation?
this question always leaves me with the headlights moment because I cannot suddenly remember any of the other books that I've read. It always happens. So you should have prepped me for this question at least. But I love reading anything that Jennifer Rackelman has written because I think I just like her writing style. I really a book, a classic book, which is The Peregrine, which is I think the book that started the whole tradition of I think natural history writing. Enjoy reading you know, M. Krishnan's work because he just writes so very well about birds and about nature in general. There's a meditative quality which I think is like balm in today's fast-paced world, I think. Yeah, this is hard. So, I mean, let me think of more examples
Yeah,
as
that's good. Yeah.
the questions, because if you, but these are the books that I would say, you know, if anybody's interested in natural history, read Krishnan, read the Peregrine, read books like Nirgunashekhar, because they give you an idea of what's happening in our jungles at this point in time. And and I think those experiences are really worth, you know, writing or talking about.
And apart from Jamalala's story, you know, which was the other most challenging essay for you to commission in the anthology?
That is not so bad. I mean, Jamal was difficult because it took me, I mean, until I found Raza, I had no hope of getting that story out. The others were relatively easy, in terms of finding finding writers and, you know, who knew their subjects well to be able to put together that kind of a profile. No problem. No
Was
worries.
it difficult to find in was any other person that was it was difficult to find information for?
Not
No.
really.
How was the information available?
Because most of the writers knew their subjects already, and that was really important for me. Like, I think Anandu had had many interactions with the spanning many years. Similarly, I think like Prerna knew Uma Ramakrishnan for many years. Neha knew Ghazala for a very long period of time. So those were, I mean, if it was challenging, I wrote two essays in the book about two women whom I didn't know at all. And thanks to travel and other issues, I've never to date met Nandini Bello. All our conversations were purely online over Zoom calls, through phone calls, WhatsApp messages. But she was incredibly generous, you know, in sort of opening up her mind, opening up her thoughts, opening up her life story. I mean, in great detail. So it was that it was challenging for me because I had to speak to a whole bunch of people and then write with authenticity. And I think, well, luckily for Divya Karnad, she happens to teach at Ashoka that semester, so she wasn't too far from me. So I managed to go across and meet her a few times. We were able to connect, and she's again a Chennai girl. So, you know, there's a certain social history that is common. You know, I know the milieu in which she grew up. So it's like, so for me, those were the two really challenging essays to commission, which I wrote myself because of, you know, having to get to know your subjects really well. My other writers, I think, they just knew their subjects really well. And that really, really helped because, you know, you get to the heart of it so quickly. You
Yeah.
get.
So did you sort of know that these like you would have identified these writers and then so you would have known that
Yes.
they knew their subjects and all of
Yeah.
that, which is why you commissioned them. Yeah.
Exactly, because that was really, really important because you can't hide in long form.
Yeah.
You can skim with 700 words. I can write on anything for 700 words, not a problem. But pushing it to a long form, when you have to look at detail, you have to look at perspective, there has to be genuine interest in knowledge, I think.
Yeah, and also to keep the reader engaged as well,
Yeah.
and give the information in an accessible way.
And
Yeah,
in the fun way, yeah, and
in a
not get
fun
too
way.
pedantic and boring and textbook style, you know, which is I think like a death knell as far as young
Yeah.
readers are concerned. Yeah, so they're unforgiving, right? If
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
can't hold them past paragraph one on page one, you're a goner. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I love writing non a long form myself, and I think there's a particular magic to it. So my last question is sort of, you know, there's so many books and there's a sort of, you know, audience for Indian Pitta, but do you think that these sort of books can go beyond that audience and help creating an interest in conservation among a broader audience as well?
That's what's been really interesting, you know. In a sense, for a book like Women in the Wild, I mean, we've been, I think the book has done so well simply because it's reached out to that audience of people beyond those interested in wildlife. And I think that's because the book is in an excess of several lines. You have one being wildlife and conservation, the other being gender and women's issues, and the third being science, you know. But then you have larger interest groups. When you are the confluence of many of several interest groups, and that's why you can sort of reach out or make an impact on a slightly, you know, wider audience. Similarly, I think Ashish Pitti's book, The Living Air, it's not meant for, not just meant for hardcore bird watchers, but for the person who just likes to be, who likes to observe things around him in his city, in his urban setting. I think that again is a very broad-based group. So I think we are reaching out to people, and I think the crux of that is accessible writing. To not make it forbidding and too difficult and too far away, right? No, I think you have to write. I think the form is as important as the content here, and I think that's how we reach out to more people.
Yeah, absolutely. And what do you think for you is the biggest difference between an yourself as an author and as an editor?
The editor's job is much easier. It's hard to write. It requires, I mean, it's exhausting. It's got many highs and many lows, more lows than highs. It's tough, when you're researching and writing, but there's a magic when it all comes together. But I actually love editing. I love the idea of putting things together. So, looking back, when people heard in the first year I was attempting an anthology, and we got the anthology out in a year. So, people were like, "Are you crazy? I mean, why are you taking this really difficult project on? Easier to deal with one author, one book." But yeah, but I just like the whole idea of weaving multiple ideas into a book, and I think it's fun. Yeah, I love anthology, so I mean, why not do more of them?
We also spoke to Himali Sodhi, who'd written the Book of the Dog, and
Yes.
it was very interesting also to hear about her perspective on how to put an anthology together and the curation of that as well. Okay, so that brings us to the last round of the interview, which is called the rapid fire round. So
Okay.
you would have to answer in one word or one sentence, and no thinking allowed.
All right.
Okay. So, one animal encounter you wish to have.
Oh, watching brown bears in Ladakh.
Wow. Okay. One character from history that you want to meet.
Charles Darwin.
Oh, that'd be super interesting. And one place you want to travel to.
Only one. That's kind of
Yeah.
hard. That's a
Okay,
difficult.
next. One place you want to travel to next.
The High Himalaya.
Hi, Himalaya. It's okay. Okay, one tip you have for writers who want to get published with Indian Pitta.
Be authentic.
Okay. What's next for you in terms of Indian Pitta? What's
More
getting
books,
published?
more books, more books, more books. We have a bunch of books coming out this year, including a revised edition of a classic wildlife book. We are doing our first autobiography, and we're doing another anthology. So what's not to like?
Wow, how many books do you publish in a year with
Well,
Indian Pitta?
last year we did three in quick trot.
Okay.
Course, I think ambitious and exhausting. And I think this year we're headed on the same headed at the same pace, I think. So
3 or 4. Wow, that's fantastic. Yeah,
let's see.
it's a lot.
Fingers crossed. Yeah, a lot of things are coming together,
So
but
you're
it's
commissioning and
early.
then also editing at the same time.
Yes, I mean, that's what I do. Yeah,
Yeah, so you would be doing around like 6, 7 projects a year.
I don't think so many. 3, 4 is more like
Three,
it,
four.
because I do spend time on each of them.
Yeah.
That's
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. Thank you so much for
Thank
letting me know
you.
more about the process of putting this book together, your journey, conservation, Indian Pitta. I mean, who doesn't love the world of animals, wildlife? Who isn't fascinated by the beauty of nature? And reading these books just transports you and just makes you feel so much more connected as a human being. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed this episode of Books and Beyond with Bound.
This podcast is created by Bound, a company that helps you grow through stories. Find us at Bound India on all social media platforms.
Tune in every Wednesday as we peek into the lives and minds of some brilliant authors from India and South Asia.